Good afternoon. I will open up the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Wednesday, March 6, 2013. And I'm opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2639. Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2639 has no revenue impact and a fiscal statement was issued. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It modifies the definition of source of income, redefines criteria for real property rental refusal of lessee, directs Housing and Community Services Department to develop Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program, creates Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program Fund, appropriates the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Program funds to the HCS, requires local housing authorities to annually report information, data, and outcomes to HCS Housing Choice Voucher Program, directs HCS to submit report to legislative assembly committees, requires HCS to create and administer stable rental housing program, requires HCS in consult with the State Housing Council to adopt rules for eligibility determination for receipt of grant funds, create stable rental housing account, and appropriates account funds to HCS, directs HCS to report stable rental housing program status and outcomes to legislative assembly committees.
Thank you, Regina. Thank you. Welcome, Speaker Pro Tem.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the Oregon House. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm a little old school, so you're getting hard copies as well, but we are posting my testimony in a Dash 5 amendment to OLIS, so that could be coming up simultaneously as I speak. So, but we also have hard copies for you as well. It's a real pleasure to be here today. I really, really appreciate the generosity of the chair and how much time we have to talk about this bill. House Bill 2639 is a product of many months of conversations with stakeholders, and it's definitely a work in progress. So I will be commenting on some things in my testimony that reflect the Dash 5 amendments. So we didn't have time to do an annotated copy, but that is the bill that I am speaking to and supporting at this point with the Dash 5. This bill comes out of an understanding that if we're going to achieve the goals we have here in the state, whether it's keeping people healthier by helping them with preventive care and in safe housing, or if we want our high school students to graduate on time, but yet their families are homeless, we as a state have to focus a lot more on housing. And that's why you see housing as part of your responsibility in this committee. I think it's been a topic area that has been largely left to local communities, yet we as a state have to deal with affordable housing as an issue in a more coordinated fashion if we're going to achieve some of the goals that we have set for ourselves here in the state, whether it's education, healthcare, or a whole variety of things. Because, you know, as we all know, if you're going to succeed, you have to have a safe place to call home. And unfortunately, we know a lot of Oregonians don't have that, and it's affecting their ability to succeed and their overall health and well-being. One of the most important programs in the state is the Federal Housing Choice Voucher Program. Many of you know it as the Section 8 program. It's changed. Its official name is the Housing Choice Voucher Program. 22 local housing authorities across the state administer this program, and it helps approximately 32,000 Oregon households every month in this state have help with their rent through this voucher program. That's about $200 million of federal dollars flowing into our state every year directly to private landlords. And it's about 13,000 private landlords participating in the program. And unlike site-based affordable housing, which you have had conversations about that here in this committee, the hallmark of this program is the flexibility it allows the voucher holder to choose where they want to live, close to a school they want their child to attend, or close to where they work, or close to services, whatever that may be. That is the benefit of this over site-based housing. In my testimony, you see just a quick snapshot of who voucher holders are. 44% of them have a disability. 4 out of 5 of them are very low income. And for a family of 3, that's just under $20,000 per year. This isn't just low-income Oregonians. Many of them are very, very low income. And 3 out of 4 households who have a voucher are headed by women. So you have a lot of women who this is their one way to keep themselves housed and stable and keep their children housed in a stable environment. The Housing Choice Voucher Program is a public-private partnership. It's been around for many, many years. It involves the tenant, the housing authority, and the landlord. And there's a little triangle here that is often used to explain the program. You see it there in my testimony with the tenant, landlord, and housing authority as an integrated triangular relationship. And each of those relationships has a document that clarifies how things are run. You have a lease between the tenant and the landlord. You have the voucher between the tenant and the housing authority in terms of the responsibilities of the tenant. And you have a payment contract between the landlord and the housing authority. It's a complex program, but it works because it is a public-private partnership. This program is really vitally important to low-income Oregonians. And currently, there's really no interaction between the housing authorities and the state. And our agency that deals with housing is the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. It's also currently legal for a landlord to say, I won't even let you apply if you have a voucher. And only landlords in Multnomah County at this point have a risk mitigation fund that helps guarantee them that if their apartment unit or rental unit becomes damaged by someone with a voucher, that they can get reimbursement. That's only in Multnomah County because of the effort there of their housing authority. So the purpose of this bill is to really maximize this program as much as possible for the voucher holder and the landlords involved in the program, because this is so incredibly important to the well-being and stability of families here in the state. And ultimately, we'd love to have more vouchers, but we have to make sure the program is working at its optimal level, and that's what this bill attempts to achieve. So the goal of the bill is to maximize outcomes for the program for both voucher recipients and landlords, strengthen the connection between the housing authorities and the state in terms of coordination and data sharing. And then there's an additional piece on here after conversations with all involved that one of the missing pieces in the state is there's not enough short-term rental assistance. So there's kind of an additional piece that's outside of the voucher program discussion, which says we as a state should make more short-term rental assistance available so families who are currently housed but are running into economic distress do not lose their housing, because it's a lot less expensive to keep someone in their home if they're missing a rent payment than wait for them to become homeless. So that's why you see the stability fund in this bill. So there's five components to the bill, and again, they reflect the Dash 5 amendments. Promoting fairness for the voucher holder, allowing a person with a voucher to apply. That doesn't mean they can necessarily be rented to, but they should have the ability to apply. For the landlords, permits the landlords to say you don't have good rental history or your voucher is not going to cover your rent sufficiently, so we're not going to rent to you. This isn't saying landlords have to take people. They need to allow them to apply. It creates a statewide mitigation fund, so landlords across the state who are in this program have the ability to have a risk guarantee fund like they do in Portland. It also encourages, to the degree that we can, to work with local housing authorities to make the inspections more timely, to help make sure the lease length is more applicable to the rental market. 12 months, having a 6-month lease versus a 12-month lease is very important for landlords. Also just trying to provide a process for landlords to get feedback to the housing authority so they can help improve the process for them. There's also support for the housing authorities. We heard very strongly that the state needs to step up and apply to the federal government for a statewide waiver to help us have more flexibility in the program. Portland currently has more flexibility because they have received a waiver from HUD, but other housing authorities in the state have not, so we're going to pursue that. We've already started to talk with our congressional delegation about that, but the bill says we will pursue that kind of waiver. It also talks about setting up a statewide housing advisory committee on this topic. So there's a mechanism going forward where landlords and tenants and the housing authorities can sit down and talk about how we improve the program going forward, you know, working on best practices. And then lastly, there's the attempt to get a little more money into short-term rental assistance by establishing a new stability fund. This is only a first step. I'm definitely in this for the long haul. I really appreciate all the partners, some of whom you'll hear from today, who've been having very honest conversations, providing a lot of good feedback on how to make this bill as good as possible. And I really do appreciate all their efforts. And I will take questions, but I also know the people coming after me are more the experts than I am. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and thank you for being willing to take questions. And I would imagine most of us have heard from constituents, and we probably have questions, although I don't see any hands jumping up. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Speaker, for being here. I'm impressed, of course, with the way you bring stakeholders together. I'll look closely at the Dash 5s. I think you've done a lot of good work here, and I'm impressed with the bill. If I could offer one criticism, with all the people you have, the congressional delegation coming in and so forth, but this is going to be mainly in Multnomah County. And if you could get somebody, I don't know, from city council in Portland, for instance, to come forward and drive down here for once, I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Gilliam, I totally agree. I think our city council needs to take a more active role, so maybe they're going to be here today. I don't know.
We're in agreement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Representative Gilliam. Any other questions?
And again, the experts are really, if you, particularly around the program, there are people who can answer more questions than I can, so.
Okay. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Speaker. I had a question from a constituent around inspections, and once the inspection is done, if it's not approved by the Section 8 or the Choice Voucher Program, are the landlords obligated to go ahead and fix the things that were in the inspection, or are they allowed to then go on and not fix it and lease to somebody who is not does not have a voucher?
Madam Chair and Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for the question. One of the biggest concerns I have that I've learned in this process is HUD requires an inspection. There's some often a lag time between a voucher holder and a landlord saying, okay, we're going to go into relationship and I'm going to do a lease, and they still have to get the inspection from the housing authority. Sometimes that takes a while, and it's a, you know, and it could be something like, you know, electric plate or a light bulb being out. What we need to figure out is how to make those inspections happen sooner, mm-hmm. so a unit doesn't have to stay open, because that's loss of revenue for the landlord, right, when they're waiting 2 weeks while an inspection has to happen. So some of that's administrative on the housing authority's part, but, you know, they don't get a lot of money to administer the program. So one of the concerns they will have is that how do you support us implement the program more efficiently. So that's, we're going to work on that. It's definitely a concern. The other issue, too, is we'd like to go forward with some flexibility in saying, can we pre-approve a set of landlords who are known to be, you know, good landlords, so they can automatically rent up and then have the inspection after they've already started renting up, and then fixing those minor issues? Because in most cases, they're minor. Mm-hmm. If there are really egregious problems, obviously you don't want someone renting there, but a lot of stuff is can be minor. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's the type of flexibility we want to pursue. We can't currently, is my understanding, but that's part of the waiver discussion. The program is not 100% perfect, and I know you'll probably hear that from the landlord groups, but my commitment is to help make that better.
Follow-up? Yes, follow-up. Thank you. And I think the other part of that was, are they obligated then to go ahead? And my understanding, having just asked this question to someone else this morning as well, I just wanted to see if it was confirmed, is that if they choose not to go ahead and make the changes that are required by that inspection, they do have that ability to say, I'm not going to make those changes. I have another renter that's willing to rent.
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, I believe so, but yeah. I think probably Steve Rubin from Home Forward and from the Portland Housing Authority could confirm that for sure.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We're letting you off easy, Madam Speaker. So we have several panels we'll be calling up, Margaret Van Vliet and Nick Fish. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'll be very brief today. As you know, my agency is going under some transformation planning efforts. What I wanted to make sure you are aware of is that I don't think that the work we're doing to think about changes in our service delivery model needs to be an impediment to this bill moving forward. We have a lot of heavy lifting to do in our agency to think about how do we deliver all of the housing services that the state is responsible for. And I feel very comfortable that if this bill is approved, we'll be in a good position to fold it into the other work we're doing and make sure it is implemented and delivered well for Oregon communities. The other thing to just stress is that I think you know I'll be back in front of you next week to provide more of a grounding on how housing funds flow through the state, what the various roles are, including our agency's role, and we can talk more about sort of transformation and impacts at that time. So I'll be back in front of you, and I just wanted to affirm that there's no reason to think that our efforts should impinge on this bill. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. Any quick questions? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, will you be back for the next bill too, or are you not?
Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnes, yes, I will be.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Commissioner Fish, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg, distinguished members of the committee. My name is Nick Fish. I'm a Portland City Commissioner, and thank you for the honor of being able to present to you this morning, this afternoon. And I also want to offer a special thank you to Speaker Kotek for her leadership in this area. The City of Portland strongly supports this legislation designed to remove barriers to housing choice statewide. This bill reflects a value that we all share, that everyone, regardless of their income level, should be able to choose what neighborhood they live in and where to send their kids to school. It also addresses a disparate impact that does not reflect our values. Section 8 is a market-based program, and our current law limits choice and has the effect of concentrating poverty. Federal rent assistance is a bipartisan concept. Republican President Richard Nixon and a Democrat Congress established the Section 8 program in 1974. As you've heard, it's the largest housing program in America. There are over 7,000 tenant-based housing choice vouchers in Multnomah County alone. Nearly half are families of four, nearly half are families earning less than $35,000 a year. One-third have a disability. About half are people of color, and one in five is an older adult. Voucher holders are veterans, immigrant families, victims of domestic violence, older adults with disabilities. They are the face of America. Because Section 8 is the largest housing program in Oregon, we have a collective responsibility to make sure that we get it right. That means doing everything we can to make it work for landlords as well. We have great partners in the landlord community, and they were instrumental in helping to shape this bill. I also want to tip my hat to Jill Riddle and the team at Home Forward for their pioneering work to reform the Section 8 program, and a lot of their good work is reflected in this legislation. Finally, I'd like to dispel a misconception about the proposal before you, and the speaker alluded to it. This bill does not require a landlord to rent to someone with a voucher. And I think we have to say that again. This bill does not require or mandate that a landlord rent to someone with a voucher. It only requires that a landlord treat a voucher holder like you and me. And the process of screening a normal, and by the way, and reserves to them the right to use a normal screening process to screen an application. But make no doubt, there will be one noticeable change. Newspapers will no longer be able to run ads that say no Section 8. This bill is a step forward for the Section 8 program, for the families and individuals it serves, and for the civil rights in the state of Oregon. I urge your support of HB 2639, and thank you for the privilege of testifying.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions, Commissioner? Seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both for coming. Next, we have Deborah Olson, Justin Burry, and Raven Settler. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Should I go first?
No.
Okay. Thank you for committee members. My name is Justin Burry, and I am the Deputy Director for the Community Alliance of Tenants, Oregon's only statewide grassroots tenant-controlled tenants' rights organization. Our mission is to educate and empower tenants to demand safe, stable, and affordable housing in Oregon, and we have over 2,000 members throughout the state. Low-income tenants, predominantly low-wage workers, families with children, people living with disabilities, seniors, and people of color are CAT's primary membership base. We know that when Oregonians have access to safe, stable, and affordable housing, they can make the best of their opportunities and succeed in life. Section 8 is a program that can provide stability for tenants with low income so they are able to live in the communities with adequate schools, transportation options, healthcare services, and economic opportunity. We should make every effort we can to improve the program we are investing in so that it works both for landlords and for tenants. Section 8 is successful in achieving the aims that it is designed for. Our organization runs the only statewide renters' rights hotline, where we talk to tenants throughout Oregon about their rights and offer tips and strategies of how to protect them. Through the hotline and membership, we identify that the lack of affordable housing is a barrier to their stability, safety, and opportunity. Safe and affordable housing options are still out of reach for many tenants. The majority of our constituents are paying well over 50% of their income for rent, many over 70%. For those who are eligible for assistance, the wait list is often many years, and if we are lucky enough to gain a voucher, it can be very difficult to find a landlord who will accept it. I have spoken to many members who have lost their voucher when the clock ran out. We are given 60 days to find a place to rent with a voucher and can ask for 2 30-day extensions for a total of 120 days. In some areas of Oregon, this is simply not enough time for them to find housing. The anxiety and emotional distress that accompanies this process can lead to long-term ailments such as depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and trigger or exacerbate physical ailments as well. And this is for tenants who actually find housing. Here is a story of one of our members. He waited 4 years to finally receive a voucher and spent 4 months searching through the neighborhoods and the classified ads, riding the bus, hitting the pavement, and looking for a place that would accept his voucher. It was a full-time job. He had help from at least 3 organizations, including CAT, and it wasn't enough. He knew the area he was looking in. He knew the bus lines. He had friends and family and work and a community there. None of the apartments he found would accept a voucher, despite his clean rental history, good credit, and no criminal history to speak of. After 120 days, he lost his voucher and the best chance he had to live in the community that supported him and he could flourish in. Thankfully, he does have housing now, but not in the area he hoped to live. He suffers from severe depression and migraines, conditions which are worsened after this experience, and access to medical facilities is usually about a 45-minute bus ride. Section 8 vouchers are intended to give responsible, low-income tenants a choice of where we can live. When we have real choice, we have better opportunities to improve our lot and contribute to our communities in a positive way by working hard, staying healthy, and connected to our friends and family. Oregon is a wonderful place to call home, and it's full of wonderful places. We should call on all of us to work together to ensure everyone has access to and opportunities to safe, stable, and affordable housing in the communities that fit their needs. Section 8 is a program that can provide the stability and affordability to Oregonians with low incomes so that they can succeed in life, provide for their family, and contribute to their community. We should all work together to ensure that it reaches these aims.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name's Deborah Olson, and I'm getting over the flu bug. I apologize, week 3. I'm an Oregonian voter who uses a Section 8 voucher. I believe these vouchers are important for the health, stability, and well-being of tenants like me. We should do everything in our power to make sure that we are available, that they are available and can be used easily. I was on the wait list for a little over 4 years, 4 long years, for my Section 8 voucher, and when I finally received one, many of the landlords would not even give me the opportunity to apply for an apartment, which I consider my home. It is hard and frustrating to be turned away. I have a decent rental history. I don't have any felonies. I don't have any misdemeanors. I will cop. I got a speeding ticket. And let's see. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I don't have problems with my previous landlords or neighbors. Many of the newspaper ads feature rental housings that say no Section 8. Do not apply. I would go to the Housing Authority every week and get their printout of that talked about places that would take Section 8 vouchers, and they were for families much larger than mine. I'm a family of one. So those were not doable, and the few that took a family of one were much higher than my voucher would allow for the rent. I'd gone through the first 60 days. I asked for an extension of another 60 days. I came very close to losing it within about a week, if memory serves me correctly. I've been in my home for 7 years, February of this year. I became disabled in 1990 due to the carelessness of a sober driver. Searching for housing was very hard for me physically. As the day progressed, I would ride the buses and walk. My legs, back pain would increase. My ankle would swell. I can do a few blocks on a good day. I wasn't able to go back to my production work. I worked in the factory for over 20 years. My Social Security disability, I get $710 a month. My rent is $710 a month. Thank goodness I have a Section 8 voucher. This voucher has provided me stable housing and security. Without it, I couldn't afford the place I live in. I've been looking to move for the last couple of years, and I'm still having some of the same problems. We do not take Section 8 vouchers. You got to make 2.5 times the amount of rent. We don't want to do the paperwork with Section 8. We don't want to wait. I did look at one place, and it wasn't doable. There were too many stairs for me, and that's a problem. I did want to live in the east side of 122nd, but I could not find a place. I'm further out. I wanted to be closer to a couple of my friends who are not as mobile and much older than I am. I just turned 57. Now, I'd also like to mention that I spend a lot of time on the buses. I do volunteer at the Community Alliance of Tenants now. And my friend Pat White, she had a Section 8 voucher, and it must have went to Section 8 heaven because she did not find a place to rent. She's 66 this year. As somebody with a disability who lives on a fixed income, I would not be able to afford a lot of the rents around Portland, and boy, they're going up. Without the assistance, I wouldn't have food on my table or to pay my heat bill. I appreciate the help that the voucher has given me, stability, housing, and I think if you guys can put out your efforts to help make it easier for people like me to find a place to rent, it would really be advantageous for a lot of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming to testify.
Hi, my name is Raven Settler, and I just wanted to say, first of all, it's a honor to be here to be able to testify as someone who used Section 8 and greatly benefited from it. I was in my early 20s when I had my Section 8 voucher, and I had a young son, and it allowed me to find a safe place to live for us. It was in a good neighborhood, and I ended up going back to college so that I could still be with him, because I was a stay-at-home mom originally, and then situations arose as they did, and he and I went out to find our own place, and with a Section 8 voucher, we found a very nice place in Lower Southeast, and it was perfect location because I could take the bus to Portland State where I was going to school. We were right around the corner from a park, and so a lot of our free time was spent there, and we were close to my family, which was really important to me. They were my support system at that time. I don't know what I would have done without that, because if I would have had to worry about trying to pay rent when I didn't have income at all, it would have been disastrous for us. And so by having a Section 8 voucher and having a safe place to live, I could focus on things that I needed to focus on, such as my education and my son. And ultimately, you know, we went through the program. I had two different places that I went to that didn't have problems finding a place. And I don't know if that was because I was a single mother and, you know, it things were different. You know, I'm not really sure, but I really felt it. It was extremely beneficial, and, you know, today I've gone through college. My son is now an eighth grader and goes to a wonderful school and has aspirations to go to Stanford. You know, he plays baseball. I mean, none of that would have been possible if I would have been worried about trying to keep a roof over our head when I didn't have the means to do it. So I believe that Section 8 is a wonderful program when used the way that it's intended to be. And I just think I feel really honored to be here today to be able to testify and share my story about my time on Section 8.
Thank you. Any questions? Anybody in this panel?
Madam Chair, are we going to have, maybe the gentleman in the middle could answer, but we're going to have other professionals from the housing?
Yes, we are.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much for coming to testify.
Thank you. And I did bring a couple of newspaper ads with circled no Section 8.
So okay. Leave those with Debbie, if you would. We have another panel, Deborah Emsi, Sybil Hebb, and Mark Dolan. Oh, we remind you to put your cell phones on mute or vibrate. Okay.
Shall I start? Okay. Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg, my name is Mark Jolin, member of the committee. I'm the executive director of JOIN. We're a nonprofit based in Multnomah County. We work with homeless people to get off the streets and back into permanent housing. And we've been very fortunate to be able to cultivate resources and relationships with private market landlords that usually allow us to successfully match someone with a Section 8 voucher to an appropriate apartment. We've been able to broker these relationships because of our success over years in raising private and local funds to support our work. Unfortunately, not every community in Oregon has the benefit of these kinds of resources and programs. In this context, the smooth functioning of the Section 8 system is essential. With the financial support that a voucher provides, tenants are able to ensure that they have decent, stable housing that is truly affordable to them. With that in place, they're able to meet the other challenges in their lives, whether it's finding work, caring for their children, recovering from trauma, perhaps domestic violence, or addressing their or their family members' health needs. This bill would do a number of things to make the Section 8 program function more smoothly, but I want to call out in particular the Stable Rental Housing Fund that's created in Section 7 of the bill. This fund will allow families to more effectively deploy vouchers by covering housing search expenses that the Section 8 program doesn't cover. Things that are routinely part of an application process, an application fee, a deposit, paying a past electric bill or landlord debt. These aren't large amounts of money, but for low-income households that have vouchers in hand, not being able to cover those kinds of expenses often is the difference between getting an apartment and not getting one. This fund also creates a critical resource for the thousands of homeless and nearly homeless individuals and families that need a Section 8 voucher but can't get one, or that don't necessarily need the permanent deep subsidy that a Section 8 voucher provides, but do need some temporary help to stabilize their housing situation. Portland and Multnomah County have had a fund in place for the past 6 years, the Short-Term Rent Assistance Program, which does both. During that period, it has allowed a coalition of about 20 nonprofits in the community to help over 4,500 households avoid eviction and nearly 2,000 transition out of homelessness back into permanent housing. The focus of that fund on eviction prevention is intentional because as providers, we're well aware how much better it is for a family and how much more cost-effective it is to prevent someone's eviction than to let them become homeless and then try to rehouse them. In our experience, it costs 3 to 5 times as much in terms of staff time and real dollars to help someone escape homelessness as it does to help them avoid becoming homeless in the first place. Through the STRAW program, each eviction prevention and placement costs an average of less than $2,000. And the percentage of people who are still in their housing a year after the emergency rent assistance ends is 79%. For many families, a Section 8 voucher would absolutely be better. But in the absence of that, the STRAW fund means the difference between living in a shelter, their car, or having an apartment. The Stable Rental Housing Fund created in Section 7 of the bill would create this tool as a statewide tool to supplement other resources and help us meet our community's housing needs. I hope you'll support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mayor, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of House Bill 2639 as well. I appreciate the comments of those who have gone before me this morning and really want to thank the speaker and all of the parties who have come together to work so hard in putting this bill and the amendments together. The Law Center, as you know, our mission is to achieve justice for low-income communities of Oregon. Our client base is 185% of the federal poverty level or below, and these are clients who struggle greatly to find access to safe, stable housing for themselves and their families. It's one of the greatest needs that they express to us when they come into our offices. We feel that having safe and stable housing is one of the cornerstones of success for families, and if we can help people achieve that goal, we've resolved many of the other issues that come that they struggle with in their lives. It's very, very difficult, as you can imagine, if you're living in a car or you're living in a shelter and you don't know which shelter you can spend the night in the next night or which place you'll have to park your car the next night, for you to manage to look at things like education and stability for your child, where you're going to manage your health care, how you're going to access other services. You're too busy struggling with the day-to-day crisis. So the ability to have our clients in safe and stable housing that's affordable to them is a huge priority. We see, unfortunately, that there is a great crisis in Oregon. There's not enough affordable housing, and it's disproportionately unavailable to people who are the most vulnerable. Single women with children, people with disabilities, often minority communities struggle more than others. The voucher program is one of the critical ways to try to address this need, and one of its key elements, as you've heard before, is that it allows tenants the choice. They can take this voucher out into the private market and negotiate with landlords and communities of their choice where there are the opportunities that they need to resolve their child's education issues, where their job might be located, where they're next to transit so that they can access other resources in other communities. And this voucher program is fantastic if it works. If it doesn't work and there's not a way to get vouchers accepted and you can't find a place to lease up, then it doesn't achieve its goal, and that's a shame. We've heard from people across the state in our offices that there are these struggles. Some communities have done a great job of working together and trying to facilitate some of those barriers and to get over those barriers, and we view this bill as one way to have the state come together as a whole to really address those problems so that the program works really well for tenants and their families, also for landlords, also for housing authorities who are charged with managing. So we think that House Bill 2639 would provide really critical protection to low-income communities of Oregon who are our clients, and also would provide great tools for landlords who are participating in the program and help housing authorities facilitate the management and coordination. We really can't thank the interested parties enough for all the work they've done over the last 3 or 4 months, and the speaker enough for her great leadership on this discussion. I guess I'll just close by saying that we're committed to working together into the future as this discussion moves forward to implementing the new programs that are created by the bill, and we think that the rest of the parties are committed to do that as well. We know that we all in Oregon have a stake in building stronger communities and in giving everyone the opportunity to succeed. Individuals benefit from that approach, as do communities, as does our state. So on behalf of all of our low-income communities, we appreciate and urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Sybil.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Imsey, and I am the Executive Director of Multifamily Northwest, formerly known as Metro Multifamily Housing Association. We represent more than 150,000 units in the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington, from large property management companies with thousands of units to mom-and-pop owners of a few single-family homes. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about House Bill 2639, which makes changes to the Section 8 program and the law regarding source of income as a protected class. But before I get to the substance of the bill, I wanted to talk about the path that led us here today. Over the past 4 years, Representative and now Speaker Kotek took the time to understand the issues involved in this very complex federal program known as Section 8. She listened to the real challenges that led some property owners and managers to not participate in the program. She worked with a wide range of stakeholders, from housing authorities to tenant advocates to property owners and managers, to navigate the sometimes conflicting positions and to try to address barriers as much as is possible in Oregon statute. We deeply appreciate the investment of Speaker Kotek and her staff, especially Tim Inman, so that they have created a more successful conversation around this subject. In its current form, the Section 8 program can be very challenging, and it is frequently misunderstood. Section 8 is a federal housing program that offers a promise of rent subsidy on behalf of a low-income tenant, but makes direct payments to property owners once the tenant and the unit are approved. This creates, as was said earlier, a triangle of relationships. The lease between the property manager and the tenant, the contract between the housing authority and the property owner, and the agreement between the tenant and the housing authority. This combination of contracts and requirements can be particularly hard on small property owners, and property owners, small and large, have experienced challenges with timely payments, inspections, and the initial lease length requirements. Although we have not seen exact amendment language, conceptually, there are real improvements to the Section 8 program in House Bill 2639. The bill, if amended, would eliminate the exception for Section 8 under the law that makes source of income a protected class, while allowing property managers and owners to conduct the same background checks and screenings that apply to all other prospective tenants. The amendment establishes a mitigation fund that increases protection for property owners from tenant damages that exceed the security deposit by $5,000 in damages. While we support that ceiling, we believe the fund should kick in right after the security deposit has been exceeded. The amendment also requires a tenant to repay the mitigation fund through a reasonable payment plan and won't extend a new voucher if the tenant won't make good faith effort to repay the fund. The amendment directs the housing authorities to ensure timely inspections, prompt payments, and establish initial leases that match the customary lease length. So for a unit in question that is typically rented in a six-month or month-to-month, it would also need to be rented to a Section 8 participant for that length of time. Finally, the bill adds oversight and ongoing feedback loop for evaluating the effectiveness of the program. There are real improvements over the current Section 8 program. At the same time, we remain concerned because despite these intended improvements, their ability to be implemented effectively throughout the state depends on support or waivers from the federal government, adequate funding, and ongoing commitment. Without each of those pieces, we are left with largely what we have today, a challenging program that should be voluntary. We look forward to working with Speaker Kotek and our congressional delegation to ensure that the federal government gives Oregon the opportunity to lead the nation in creative and effective problem solving once again. Multifamily Northwest believes an amended House Bill 2369 may help move more lower income renters into housing more quickly than before, and it will reduce several of the barriers that exist for tenants, housing authorities, and property owners. But this bill is not a cure-all for all low-income housing challenges. The Section 8 program does not build a single additional unit of affordable housing, nor does it change the fact that a voucher of any level can buy a whole lot more housing in some parts of the city than others. Multifamily looks forward to our ongoing work together to make the Section 8 program a more effective housing tool for Oregonians. I'd be happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, all of you there. But Representative Wisnett, I thought you would have a question.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much. So, Mrs. Ismael?
Imzi.
You're talking about the Dash 5?
Yes.
Okay. So that's your... okay.
Correct.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Go ahead. Follow up. Ms. Hebb, can you tell me, the paperwork we had says there's 32,000 households statewide. Do you have an idea of the percentage or number of those in the Portland metro area?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, I don't have that. Perhaps the housing authorities, who will be testifying later, I believe, may have that information for you.
And Madam Chair?
Yes. Follow up?
Thank you. It was stated by the lady testifying earlier that the rental policy is 2.5 times your income to rent a facility. Is that legal? Is that policy? Is that unwritten rule? Or what?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I believe that the previous witness was testifying to a rule that a particular landlord had in criteria that the landlord had set. And this bill would not change the criteria that landlords can set in terms of how they screen their tenants. Anything that they can lawfully do now, they could continue to do and apply to Section 8 tenants. All the bill does is ask that those criteria be applied equally to Section 8 tenants, just like they are to any other tenant. And so income criteria that a tenant, that a landlord had would remain unchanged.
Thank you. One last quick one. Thank you.
Follow up.
I have one letter from a constituent, I think it's a constituent, we get all these, that says he rents month to month. How would that work in this?
Representative Tomei, Representative Wisnett, members of the committee, the Section 8 federal regs, and others may speak more specifically about this after me, there is a federal reg that indicates that the initial lease-up term of a person using a Section 8 voucher is to be 1 year. There is the authority for the housing authority to waive that requirement and to have a different term, taking into consideration what the normal practice of business is in that area. Given that dwelling unit and practices in that area. And so the bill directs the housing authorities to look at that and make that consideration and consider and move forward with lease terms that are less than a year, if that's appropriate. The other thing that I would say about that, and one question that's come up, is that people have wondered whether a landlord would be forced to have a year term lease for any reason, even if that was the current practice in the area generally. And there's nothing in the bill that would require a landlord to change the term of a lease that the landlord had, so long as that was part of the criteria that the landlord used for any other tenant. So I just want to make that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jolin, you mentioned that the bill would provide for covering housing search expenses, and you mentioned past electric bills. Are there other utility bills that would be considered, and how much would it pay? Do you have a limit on what you intend to allow in that?
Chair Tomei, Representative with the members of the committee. The language, and there may be someone else who can answer this question better, I don't believe sets parameters around that, but provides some directive to set those kinds of parameters to the administrative body, which I think is going to be OHCS. So, but it does contemplate a broad notion of what kinds of expenses can be covered if covering those expenses is an immediate barrier to someone being able to either deploy their Section 8 voucher or otherwise get into housing or retain their housing.
Follow up?
So are you saying this is going to be set by rulemaking then outside of the legislative body by agency?
I'm going to, if I can, defer the question because it's not.
Sure. Chair Tomei, Representative Witsit. Section 7 of the printed bill, it's at the bottom of page 5, sets out this program. It provides some parameters around expenses, as Mr. Jolin mentioned, to support housing stability and to prevent homelessness. And so there's a list of things like fees and deposits and past due electric or rent bills. And then the agency, OHCS, which would be administering the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency. Sorry, trying not to use acronyms. Would be charged with providing a rulemaking process around what that would look like, how people would apply, and how those funds would be administered. It also gives the agency the ability to make grants to local organizations to do that work on a community and very localized basis. Those organizations are the ones who generally have the best idea about what the priorities ought to be in their communities and what the greatest needs are.
Follow up?
So will it be basically county by county that decides when you talk about agency, or is it going to be set for the state that you decide how much, you know, is it limited to $5,000 past rent and utilities, or $25,000. I mean, is this going to be a state thing, or is this going to be local according to each individual county or city?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, I believe it's a combination. So the subsection 2 of Section 7 directs the subject to the State Housing Council, the department, to establish rules around what sorts of expenses would qualify and who would be eligible for those expenses. And then the department under subsection 3 of Section 2 will also adopt rules to determine the eligibility of organizations in local communities that would receive grants to distribute those dollars according to the rules that the agency set out.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Convert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, I come from a part of the state with a terrible housing challenge. We've got so many people working in the service industries, and their minimum wage incomes just don't keep pace with the cost of housing out on the coast. And so I like this bill. I like that it provides opportunities for tenants, and it provides some opportunities as well and protections for landlords. That being said, I'm a small business owner.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I do, and okay. I wanted to get to that. I just wanted to provide the context. I'm a small business guy, and I'm familiar with the challenges of trying to work with agencies and not having lawyers and managers to support me without. And I wanted to invite Ms. Eismead to just expound a little bit on the challenges faced by the smallest of landlords in this process.
Chair Tomei, a representative, it is a program, and that's one of the reasons why our position has been for many, many years that as a program for particularly a small landlord, it can be very problematic if you don't have a major accounting department to back you up in order to put those pieces together. There has been certainly effort in this bill to try, it's not going to do anything about the paperwork, but it is going to try to do speed things up in terms of the inspection program and also in terms of the mitigation fund. It will give a landlord who, quote, doesn't have deep pockets, the ability to be made at least partially whole if for some reason the voucher holder does damages or doesn't pay their rent.
Follow-up? No, I'm sorry. Your answer was shorter than my question.
Any further questions? Thank you all so much for the work you've done on this. Our next panel is Chris Bilhart, Melissa Erlbaum, and Kate Sorum.
Just remember that. Let's see what you're talking about.
Please identify yourself.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you so much for making time for this hearing today. My name is Chris Bilhart, and I live in Northeast Portland, and I'm also the director of Home Free, which is a domestic violence intervention program operated by Volunteers of America, Oregon. And I would like to say a few words about how I think passage of House Bill 2639 could positively impact the safety and well-being of domestic violence survivors and their children. And you've already heard mention that they're a large chunk of the population that we're talking about in terms of those in need of housing and Section 8 assistance. Domestic violence survivors and their children is an extremely important population to consider when discussing access to housing options. The face of homelessness has been changing in this country for the past 10 years, with many more families among the homeless. And most of these families are headed by women. 80% of those are victims of domestic violence, so it's got a huge impact for this population. Many survivors of domestic violence lose their housing when they flee domestic violence, which is what we tell them to do. That's what we want to see happen, is to leave and go to safety. But then that starts them off down a path of temporary and often not great housing situations, in and out of shelters, doubling up with family and friends when possible, maybe back to shelter. It can start a course of instability that can last for many years. Even more disturbing is the fact that many survivors of domestic violence stay in their abusive situations to avoid homelessness, or they return to the abusive situation when they aren't successful at living independently. At Home Free, we started providing housing, permanent housing help for survivors about 15 years ago, and recognizing all these dynamics. Our program model was designated as a best practice by the National Alliance to End Homelessness, and we also participated for about 5 years in a Centers for Disease Control funded study called the SHARE Project that looked at the health impacts of housing instability above and beyond the impact of the violence on domestic violence survivors and their children. The interplay between domestic violence and a survivor's ability to control and run her own life can make for many barriers to housing. She may have ruined credit, a spotty job history. There's a lot of sabotage that goes on in terms of efforts to gain independence from the abuser. There may be a history of running out on leases because she was fleeing the violence. There may be arrears and many other issues requiring advocacy. Domestic violence has other impacts as well, of course. The survivors in the SHARE study, the CDC-funded study, had post-traumatic stress scores that were as high or higher than those of returning combat veterans. And this trauma affects many areas of life that make it hard to carry on a job search or a housing search. We found at Home Free that pairing flexible financial assistance and rental subsidy with ongoing support and domestic violence advocacy services can help survivors retain their housing, and our retention rates are over 90% for survivors who have received our services, and this is at a year after exit from services and no longer being subsidized. The SHARE study found that housing stability has significant and dramatic positive effects for survivors. As housing stability improves, so does general health. Women are safer, so it increases safety. The post-traumatic stress and depression that they have such high levels of are really reduced by the stability of housing. Day-to-day functioning improves, and they're able to carry on employment and go to school and all those things. And their children experience these impacts too. As one survivor in the study said, housing made everything else possible. So healing from domestic violence started with having a safe and stable place to live. Now, we can't achieve these outcomes without landlords. We love our landlords. So many of them have come alongside us, and they really see how integral they are to a survivor safety plan. They're part of her establishing that foundation and first step. Now, this House bill contains provisions, and I am not a legislative analyst, so please don't ask me detailed questions about the bill. I'll defer to the smarter people in the room about that. But I know from looking at the general provisions of it that it contains some that remove barriers for landlords, that are good for domestic violence survivors and their children, and that provide tools for programs who are working to ensure that survivors don't think that escaping domestic violence has to mean descending into homelessness. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today and giving us your testimony.
Thank you.
You know, we have, I think, 5 or 6 more people who are signed up to speak on this bill, and we have another bill, and some people have come over 100 miles to be here to testify. I want to make sure everybody has time to testify. So if you could sort of limit your testimony a little bit, that would be wonderful. But thank you for coming. Go ahead.
Well, that you queued me up perfectly, because mine is actually very quick. My name is Melissa Earlbaum. I'm the Executive Director for Clackamas Women's Services and also a Clackamas County resident. And I'm here just to share with you the success that we've had. We're a domestic and sexual violence service provider, like Chris was speaking of. And we formed a partnership with our housing authority and the landlords that we've been working with for a number of years, about 3 years ago, so that we could have 24 vouchers a year designated specifically for domestic violence victims. In the last 3 years that we've had that program in Clackamas County, we've had 0 of those vouchers turned back, which means all of those families are still in housing. It's very successful. Because of that success, we had 100 vouchers allocated this year because the landlords, the housing authority, and the social service providers were working together. The problem is we have only been able to house 10% of those, a little less than 10% of those, because the landlords that are working with us they're full with those, and we're wanting to open it up and educate landlords and provide them with the support that they need to be able to take the vouchers for those other 100 households that we know can be just as successful as the ones before them. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Kate Sorum, and I am the case manager and family advocate at Salem Interfaith Hospitality Network, where we work with a local network of churches who provide dinner, overnight stay, and breakfast on an emergency basis for homeless families, and they come to the day center to work with me to move into housing and work towards their needs. I'm really excited to talk about the importance of Section 8 voucher. This is something that is stable for families. They're able to focus on not just those basic needs, but the core issues. And coming from a case management perspective, we're always looking for something that's going to be successful long-term, and this is something that Section 8 can provide. What we're finding in our area is that about 50% of landlords are not accepting Section 8 voucher applicants. And this is making the process to find housing even longer. It's creating unnecessary stress. It's making it very hard. And as you know, the longer it takes, it's very possible that these families can then lose their voucher and then they're starting over again. It's very hard. Stable, affordable housing through Section 8, it really helps us focus on that long-term success for families, that long-term self-sufficiency, where families can not only find jobs but careers. Kids are not having their school disrupted. It's less emotional stress. You can focus on your parenting, your relationships. There's higher quality housing as well. They're around places where they can access resources that they need, again, for the long-term success. I think it's really, really important because, like I said, what we're able to do is when I call back long-term and check in with families who have received Section 8 and have moved into housing, I know that these are going to be the numbers where they answer because their phone still is on. They have a career. The kids are still in school. They're doing fun things like celebrating birthday parties and able to just be human. And when you talk to them about their future, they actually want to because they're not focusing on where they can get in with that voucher. They now have a home and can focus on how they're going to be as a stable core unit as a family. Quickly, I worked with the family. They were fleeing an unsafe home, a young couple with a baby. We were able to get them in through the Section 8 housing into stable housing through the voucher program. I checked in on them again 8 months later, and I continue to do this again and again, and we now have it to where Alex, the dad, has a career, very stable job. Mom is working half-time and taking parenting classes and has enrolled for school next fall. The baby's doing phenomenal. It's a really, really amazing thing to see down the road, long-term, what happens when we're able to not just focus on those necessities of getting them housing and jobs, but really focus on the core issues that are the emotional, the familial, the support system that they all need. And by being able to provide this and providing more opportunity for families, we're seeing far more success with families in the long run. Thank you for this opportunity to speak and testify on behalf of this bill.
Thank you all for the work you do, and thank you for coming to testify. Let me see if there are any questions.
Madam Chair, quick. How do you lose a Section 8? And one of the other witnesses said it took 4 years on the wait list. What can you tell us that they're not?
You have a certain amount of time to be able to find housing that will be accepted. And what's happening, though, is that they're not even being accepted as an applicant. So not even being able to apply has delayed the process of actually coming through with this to get a home of their own.
Follow up, Matt, real quick. So this is a match. So you have Social Security, you have a job to make you come up. So if you lose the job, too, that income, so that loses the Section 8, too. Is that correct? Would that influence losing the Section
8? No.
Okay. Thank you.
But you have a certain amount of time to apply.
That's correct.
And if you can't find a place,
then you lose it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry. Representative Gallegos.
Just sort of a follow-up on that. If you do, say, lose your status, standing, do you go to the back of the line?
You start over.
You start all over, and you've got that wait list in front of you again.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again for the work you do, and thank you for coming to testify today. Now we have Phil Owen, Jim Straub, and Steve Redman. Again, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to ask you to be a little bit brief. I know you've been waiting a while, and I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name's Phil Owen. I'm the legislative chairman for the Rental Housing Association of Greater Portland. The RHAGP is a nonprofit organization. We were founded in 1927, and we are an organization of 1,745 members, which supports them with training and forms and the things that they need to know to do a better job in the industry. And we appreciate Speaker Kotek involving us in this conversation. In conjunction with this bill, we had surveyed our members about their participation and thoughts about Section 8. Many of them are participants in Section 8 and have had good success with it. There are a lot of our members that have tried Section 8 and have had problems, have cost them a lot of money and a lot of headache. And so they feel that this is something that was designed originally as a volunteer program, and it should be remain a volunteer program. We are not public housing. We are privately owned property. We have more expenses than your standard homeowner, and we don't get any more services for our taxes than they do, because we have to pay our business taxes and the other city fees that are levied against us. And we just feel that we do train our people an awful lot in for housing, and we train them what the rules for discrimination is, and we don't condone any discrimination of any kind. But this is private housing, and we are, the 90% of our members have less than 10 units. So we are the small business person trying to make a living, and we don't feel that we should be forced to enter into contracts with federal agencies when we're private and we don't have that. Some of the things that the bigger landlords might have with the attorneys and the accountants and what have you. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Owens, you heard my question earlier, and I also have the letter from your president, Ms. Carpenter, who reiterated some of the points that you've made. Since a landlord, for purposes of this bill, is defined as a landlord who's already working with a public agency for tenant relief, how realistic is the concern that that your members, the smallest ones, don't have the resources to work with another agency if they're already working with one agency?
Which agency were you referring to they're working with already?
Well, it says local housing authority means a landlord means an owner of a dwelling unit that has entered into an agreement with a local housing authority to receive tenant-based assistance payments under the Housing Choice Voucher Program. So it seems like, you know, we're already talking about people that are in some kind of program, and we're concerned that that this Section 8 program is going to add an additional burden. Am I misunderstanding something here?
I think we're missing the issue. We're saying that those that aren't involved with the housing authority right now should not be forced to be involved with the housing authority. We're saying that they should have the choice of whether or not they want to participate in the Section 8 program.
Thank you. You're welcome. Any further questions?
Just for clarification, if they were allowed to apply, the landlords would still not be forced to accept them, correct? Under this bill.
Under this bill, what they're saying is that you can't use their income as a criteria for whether or not you rent to them. And that you can't say that they can't.
So, for clarification, I believe the bill says, and I would love to see this if I have the understanding correct, the bill says you cannot use their income to discriminate on whether they apply, but not on whether you accept them as a tenant. Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
My understanding is that you can't use that as a criteria to turn them down either, because what they're saying is that because of the Section 8 program, they can afford the rent.
So I think that's a huge clarification that's needed on the part of the landlords, because that's my understanding of the bill. And if that's what your landlords think, I think that would need to be clarified. So maybe somebody after this can clarify. That seems like a really big clarification point.
And we'll try to find that clarification. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hello. My name is Jim Straub. I want to thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to speak with you on behalf of the Oregon Rental Housing Association. We're an organization representing thousands of landlords and 15 local chapters across the state of Oregon. 90% of our members have only one or two rental properties. Although the ORHA does not currently support House Bill 2639, we're very much interested in making every good faith effort to ensure good laws made in Oregon. We come before you not just as landlords, but as small business owners. As any good business owner can tell you, successful business thrives by mitigating risk. House Bill 2639 asks us to participate in a federal low-income housing program that complicates our businesses and increases the burdens on small business owners. If the ORHA is expected to support this bill, we must have the assistance in mitigating the risk created by it. After all, landlords are in the business of leasing their properties. We want to see our properties rented, and we don't care who leases them, as long as they take care of our properties, are good neighbors, and pay the rent on time. Remember, our tenants are our customers. We don't have a business without them. We are asking this committee's support to help us lessen our risks and make it easier to rent to low-income tenants. There are two primary ways this can be done. Number one, create an oversight committee consisting of landlord representatives, housing authorities, officials, government officials, and other stakeholders. This committee should be more than simply an advisory committee, which is proposed now. We need something with some teeth in it. It would monitor the success of the program, provide structure, and provide an avenue of appeals for program regulations. Number two, Section 3.2C limits the maximum allowable recovery from the Landlord Mitigation Fund. Capping the amount landlords recover from the mitigation fund is in no way equitable. This bill is asking landlords to take on significant business risks, then limits their ability to recoup their losses. While we believe there should be no monetary cap, if one should be instituted, then we recommend a limit of $10,000, which Oregon courts have said is a small recovery under the small claims court system. If this seems like it's a steep limit to you, let me give you an example of damages which landlords frequently face. A call last week to a local carpet company yielded a cost to replace rental grade carpet in a 1,500 square foot house at over $4,000. If carpet is damaged, I can almost assure you there will be other damages that need repair as well. So a recovery limit of a mere few thousand dollars is woefully inadequate in this business environment. If landlords alone are to assume the financial risk to their small businesses by participating in this program, it should be mission critical to help landlords mitigate their losses, and not just a small portion of them. Remember, this is not ultimately program money. The tenant's future participation in the program requires that they pay the damages back to the program. The tenant caused the damage, the tenant should pay for the damages. All of it. We ask this committee today to recognize that all stakeholders should be protected in this bill and take action on our recommendations to protect the rights of landlords, small business owners. Thank you.
So I have a question to you. I've had and continue to have rentals, and I've had one Section 8, which was very successful, but we've had other rentals where there's been a lot of damage done, and we were not able to recover the amount. So what I'd like from you is some a study on how many the rentals in your organization, what kind of damage is done by the general public, and what kind of damage might be done by the Section 8.
I can tell. I'm a landlord. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not really a paid representative. I'm a landlord first. So this is what I've done for 23 years. My father did this. My grandfather did this.
I'm asking for his figures, because I think what you're saying is that if it's a Section 8 person does damage, then there should be some compensatory help from either the state or the federal agency. What I'm saying is, what proportion of people who aren't Section 8 also do damages that are difficult to recover?
That's a good question, but I think behind that question, you should be asking what's different between the Section 8, or what, from a landlord's perspective, makes us not want to rent to a Section 8 tenant versus a regular tenant. They both might do the same amount of damage, but a Section 8 tenant, by nature of the program, is low income. Our ability to collect damages from that individual is limited. We can't garnish wages. We can't go after assets already. An individual not on the Section 8 program theoretically has a higher income that we could get a court order to garnish a certain amount to make us whole for the damages.
Okay. I appreciate hearing that. Thank you. Okay. And what I'd like maybe is from some of the rental organizations, if you could get those, get us those figures, that would be really helpful for us to know. Thank you. Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Rudman. I'm representing the Oregon Housing Authorities, statewide association of 22 local housing authorities, providing safe and affordable housing throughout the state. And the economic value that we provide to the state collectively is well over $800 million, and we assist in housing over 35,000 households. I'm also the executive director of Home Forward, the new name of the Housing Authority of Portland. We serve all of Multnomah County, and we're the largest affordable housing provider in the state, assisting some 15,000 households with 8,500 housing choice vouchers, or what's known as Section 8. About half the households we assist are seniors and people with disabilities. I think by now you know that this is a pretty complex triangular partnership between a landlord, the tenant, and the housing authority that really has a federal and local dimension in terms of partnerships and public and private. And now what this bill and what Speaker Kotek's leadership is doing is looking at what's an appropriate state role in that mix. And as you heard a little bit, there are some limitations to the current program. First, by nature, there's financial barriers for the folks who we're talking about. The one thing they share in common is they don't have a lot of resources, a lot of income. And so it's difficult to find a place to live and to come up with the upfront costs necessary to find a place. Second thing, it is a federal program, and federal programs come with a lot of regulations. And it is particularly onerous on the smaller or the rural public housing authorities to actually meet these administrative requirements that HUD imposes, Housing and Urban Development, federal government imposes. And particularly now, since we've been several years of cuts in administration, and right now we're all reeling from the sequestration, which is going to hit affordable housing and the housing authority and the tenants very hard, because of the 5% sequestration that's happening. The impact is, we're still trying to calculate, but it's not good. And so the third one, and maybe the most important, is this is a market program, and markets change. The dynamic real estate markets change. And the majority of landlords are going to try to look at renting to what the market can bear. And so, and in weak markets, you have more landlords interested in renting to Section 8 participants than in strong ones. And so we're trying to have a government program that that really is depending upon the private marketplace. So it's very complex. The Oregon Housing Authorities really support the balanced approach that I think many speakers have been talking about, that Speaker Kotek brought together everybody, all the stakeholders, into the table. And we think there's like five key elements to the bill that is amended. One is that what it really tries to do is make sure that prospective tenants at least have the opportunity to submit an application. It's an opportunity to apply. Second, I think it's important, it was mentioned before, that like any other tenant, landlord should have the ability to receive financial compensation in the event that the tenancy ends badly. The knowledge that there will be some compensation might help a reticent landlord to take another look at this program, and we really shouldn't be penalizing landlords who want to do the right thing. Third, there's a wraparound in Speaker Kotek's bill of support to try and provide flexible dollars to try to help fill in the gaps and really find ways to make the linkages between the tenant and the landlord in various communities. Home Forward, we enjoy a deregulated flexibility that no other housing authority in the state does. So we've been able to pilot some of the measures that are in this bill, such as a landlord guarantee fund, an incentive RFE for new landlords to participate, and we have done pretty well. Where the success rate, there's two different things. We're all utilized. We can fill the Section 8 pull up with somebody, but if you, when what you hear is when people have the 120 days and they fail, it means the utilization, somebody else will take it, right? And so you want that first person to succeed. So we're getting about an 82 to 85% success rate for the folks who have that time to find a landlord to rent because of many of the measures that we brought in probably the tightest market in the last 40 years in the Portland metropolitan area. Fourth, the bill also provides for increased communication between the landlord groups and the housing authorities. And fifth, it recognizes that there's going to be needs to have some federal improvements to the program and commits the state to try to work with localities to see that Oregon can achieve this throughout the state. It's just very important to understand that it's, even though we're one state, we're a lot of different communities, and particularly small or rural housing authorities have a much more difficult time having the resources to really accommodate a landlord, a private sector program. But at the end of the day, we believe that this bill does have a balanced approach to support landlords and tenants while respecting the constraints that housing authorities face. We think it's important that this is a good first step, that we should move forward, and we can improve the program now, and we can look to find ways, working with the federal government, to make it more possible. The need is outstanding. We opened up the waiting list in Multnomah County for the first time in 6 years, and there were 20,000 applicants that applied in 1 week. So we'll be lucky to serve 3,000 in the next 5 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. And we have...
Excuse me, Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to say that in my question to Mr. Owen, I may have misread or misapplied one of the sections of the bill, and I'm going to get some clarification from staff on that later, but if I did misread it, I apologize.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. We have Cody Cox, Leslie Beachwood, Dean Hunter, and Courtney Goodman. And I'm sorry, committee, can you stay until 5? Great, thank you. Because we have another bill and we have people who've come from over 100 miles and I want to make sure we can make sure to get their testimony. So if I'm sorry to ask you to speed it up.
Thank you very much.
I have something important
Madam
to
Chair,
say.
Members of the committee, I'm Cody Cox. I am president of Northwest Real Estate Investors Association, or Northwest REIA for short. Also, by way of disclosure, I am also an employee of the state of Oregon. I do work at the Oregon Housing and Community Services Agency on the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative, or OHSI. To be clear, my testimony today is solely as the president of Northwest REIA and in no way represents the position of Oregon Housing. Margaret doesn't need my help in that. So Northwest REIA is a membership-driven 501c6.
Could you tell us what that stands for, those letters, what they stand for?
For Northwest REIA? Northwest
yes.
Real Estate Investors Association.
Thank you.
Okay. My apologies. We consist of about 300 members with a lot of variety of real estate investing investors there. We have remodelers, rehabbers who are taking vacant properties and clearing up and cleaning up various neighborhoods, buying bank-owned property and bringing them back into the marketplace and beautifying neighborhoods. We have owners of manufactured home parks who are bringing affordable housing to the state of Oregon as well. And of course, we have landlords. Our mission at Northwest REIA is to provide educational guidance and direction for our membership as they provide the housing opportunities within the state. We are also part of a national organization, so therefore we have oversight and guidelines that we must adhere to with that. So as you must anticipate, my testimony is in opposition to the proposed bill. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about some of the issues that we typically see or can see. I think we've heard of that, a lot of that already, and a lot of what I might say might be repetitive in some regards. So in the issue of brevity, I'll speed it up just a little bit. But again, as it has been said before, most of the landlords that we have in our organization are mostly, you know, small-time mom-and-pop type of organizations. These are the guys that are mowing the lawn on the Saturdays or fixing the leaky toilet instead of having dinner with their family. And so most of these guys also could be just accidental landlords. Maybe they were trying to buy a house in another part, couldn't sell their current home, and therefore they end up being a landlord with, you know, just by accident. A lot of them are just barely able maybe to cover their mortgage payments and the taxes and insurance and put aside just a small amount for maybe some unexpected repairs. And if it wasn't for the miracle of depreciation, they may not cash flow that property on their own. So there's a lot of costs that we see in this bill that is really going to have a huge effect on a lot of the smaller landlords, which again is most of our membership. I have some concerns about the inspections. We heard previously today, you know, that there's delays in inspections, and in a lot of situations these small landlords cannot afford, you know, extended vacancies. The mortgage payment still continues whether they have rental income coming in or not. So any delays in that, and I also would anticipate that, you know, if this bill passes, that there's going to be a rush for inspections. And so do we have enough staff for inspectors in order to get out to the rural parts of the state? How are those folks going to be trained? Is there costs associated with that? And where's those costs coming from? And so, you know, I have some concerns about the initial rush. So we'll probably be having to hire, you know, a significant amount of initial inspectors. But then as the rush subsides, what are we going to do with those guys? Because that could probably mean a layoff because now we have too many inspectors. So that's some of the concerns I have. And
if you have anything in writing, you can give it to Debbie.
We have already. So there's some things that we have. We have an attorney who has helped us prepare some of our testimony as well, and we've given it to Ms. Neely, and she will be passing that out to you guys on the committee. So with that, I'll relinquish back to you.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate you coming. Go ahead.
My name is Leslie Beachwood. I'm a member of Northwest REIA. I'm a licensed real estate broker in the state of Oregon, although my company is commercial, so I don't have any particular expertise in residential. I do help my mother with her rentals. She's got two rentals. They're not in this state. But when I'm reading this bill, I would like to address some of the previous testimony of some people who said that this bill does not in any way change the way landlords are able to screen from how they've previously done it, other than that they cannot de facto rule out somebody with a housing voucher as long as everything else is, you know, the same. And I would like to point the committee's attention to Section 1, Numbers 2, A, and B, because I really think, as written, those sections completely change the way that landlords will be able to screen, because it says a person may not, because of these protected classes, including source of income, A, refuse to sell, except for these exceptions, 1, based on the past conduct of the prospective renter as a renter, or 2, when the amount of rent exceeds the income of the prospective renter, taking into account the value of the voucher plus their income. I think those two things dramatically change the ability of landlords to screen their tenants, and I think it also is in conflict with some other statutes in Oregon. 90.100, which addresses some of the screening or admission criteria that landlords may use, but does not restrict them to those. So there's a laundry list of things that landlords may use. And then 90.304, when they say that landlords have to give reasons for denial, they give a laundry list of some of the reasons landlord may deny a tenant, one of which is insufficient income. As I read it, 2B here says that when the amount, you can refuse to rent to someone when the amount of rent exceeds the income of the prospective renter, taking into account the value of the income plus the voucher. I think that would mean, and unless I'm wrong, and I'd like to be corrected, that if my rent is $1,000 and your income plus your housing voucher is at $1,001, I cannot refuse to rent to you. I think, as stated, I think that's what it says. And so I think this is changing other parts of Oregon statute, and it's also alarming to landlords and prospective landlords, and will sink many landlords if somebody chooses to fight, you know, their disqualification based on this, the reading of this statute. And My mother has two rentals in New Hampshire, of all places, and we have certain screening criteria, and one of mine is that they have to have 3 times the rent in income, and I applied that across the board. I have found anything less than that, and people cannot make the rent, and they start to either miss the rent or they miss their utility bills, and basically they fail and we fail. And so I would like to make sure that whatever bill happens here does not restrict in these manner the ability of a landlord to screen even-handedly across the board.
I think that the Dash 5 amendment, do you have a hold of that one, the Dash 5
Didn't
amendment?
Didn't I get that one.
Okay,
no.
I think that addresses your concerns.
Okay.
And so if after looking at that you still have concerns, mm-hmm. would you put that in writing and give it to our staff?
Certainly.
I appreciate you coming. Thank you so much.
Okay, my name is Dean Hunter.
Dean, could you put it a little bit away from you? Put the speaker.
I've been sitting in the back and I couldn't hear. So.
Oh. When you're too close, it creates a funny sound.
Okay, okay, good. You tell me when it's okay.
Oh, I is think this you're okay? fine now.
Okay.
Perfect.
I'm a new real estate investor. I'm a member of Northwest Real Estate Investors Association and a prospective landlord. I've been a landlord in the past. And the part of this that excites me is the part where we are creating a new group of litigants with rights. My experience prior was that as I go to court to evict someone, as soon as my renters, former renters, walk through the door, a group of attorneys attack them and offer their services to find loopholes for them. And what I see this does is gives them a whole new group that they can use as clients. And that disturbs me. Another thing that impresses me about the Section 8 thing is that not only does it provide housing for low-income people, but it also keeps many people staffing organizations to be sure that their rights are taken care of and are honored. And so it also keeps others from becoming Section 8 applicants. It doesn't sound like to me that this particular thing, including low-income Section 8 applicants as a protected class, really adds stability to the process. And for me, as an aspiring landlord, it gives me pause to have so many things to worry about as a group of litigants.
Thank you very much for
Thank
coming
you very
to testify.
Much.
And if you want to put something in writing, you can do it anytime you want and give it to Debbie. That would be really great, and we would all get a hold of that and make sure we understood what you were
coming. I'll do that.
Coming.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you so much for coming today. And I think we have one more person. Courtney Goodman? Okay. And I'm going to ask you to be really quick. Thank you.
30 seconds.
Thank you.
I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Courtney Goodman, longtime member of Northwest Real Estate Investors Association in Portland. And like Cody said, we're a nonprofit educational group, and we've been around for a long time, keeping our members, our investors, safe and ethical in this ever-changing business. And I just took a few notes here. I'm fine with accepting an application for a Section 8 tenant. I don't want to be obligated to accept them as a tenant. I think this, like it's been said before, it elevates a Section 8 tenant to or someone with a voucher to a protected class and opens up the door to a lot of discriminatory based lawsuits. I don't want to see, I hope that's not the intent here. I'm sure it isn't the intent, but we try to look forward on some of these bills as the members I'm sure do and look at the consequences of what's being written. So we're not getting into the muck down the line because of a bill that's maybe not necessary. I think there's tweaks and changes that have to be made to make it viable for more people in this program, but to you know, if it's not an obligation for a landlord to accept, then let's see that written right into the bill. We've lobbied on some other bills and made amendments to have one little sentence put in that makes everyone happy, members of the committee, House and Senate, and members of the public that are lobbying, you know, to make some tweaks. So maybe that's just the simple solution, is just to put a little language into the bill that says, hey, there's no obligation here, but you can't put in an advertisement that we're not going to accept a Section 8 tenant, and I agree with that. I think that's discriminatory on its face right there. So maybe a little tweaks just to make everyone happy.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate and again, it. If you'd like to give something in writing to the staff, that would be great.
Thank you so much.
And I think our last speaker is Janet Bird.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for taking time. I'll be very brief. I submitted written testimony. I just wanted to make a couple points in closing. I'm Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and I'm here today on behalf of the Housing Alliance, which is a statewide coalition with a very broad membership concerned about housing opportunity. You will hear me over the course of this legislative session talk to you endlessly about the housing needs in our community. They are overwhelming, and just this week there was data released that shows we're fourth from the bottom of all states in the amount of housing units that are available for folks with very low incomes. For folks who have extremely low incomes by HUD definition, there are 20 prospective renters for every four units. So it's like this very perverse game of musical chairs. I mean, there just is not enough housing for folks with very low incomes. Given that, plus the fact that the Section 8 program is our biggest tool to address this need, we have to make this system work. And it needs to work for everybody. It needs to work for tenants as well as for landlords and for housing authorities. It needs to work for our communities. So we're very excited by House Bill 2639. We're really impressed with the hard work that's gone in by all parties. We do feel that it represents a balanced approach that particularly with the Dash 5 amendments, that it does address the needs and the big concerns that have come forward, and we really urge you to support it. I want to also say that there have been a few instances in other states where this legislation has moved forward. We've seen that work. We'd be happy to provide you with information about that. Just to clarify, we believe that with the Dash 5 amendments, what this bill does is it says that Section 8 tenants with a Section 8 voucher, get screened the same way other tenants do. So we're not saying they become a special protected class. We're saying they get treated like everybody else. And it's not, you know, landlords still get to look at past behavior. They need to get to look at income ratios, income to rent ratios, but people get a chance to get looked at. We're just asking for that level playing field. We also are particularly supportive of the idea of a risk mitigation pool. There have been actually several examples over the course of the years of risk mitigation pools that have been set up. It does help landlords feel safer moving into this uncharted territory, if you will. We find that the claim rates are actually quite low, and it would be our expectation that this would be the case as well for this, but we do very much support the idea of a risk mitigation pool. We're also really excited about the idea of a stable rental housing pool. The Section 8 program is not particularly flexible, and we do find that our partners on the ground in communities really need flexible resources. In some instances, to help people get off Section 8, the Section 8 voucher, once you have it, is so valuable and so precious that there's actually a disincentive to move on. And if our community partners could, for example, offer some sort of safety net for folks going off of Section 8, we would see an improvement in the program. I want to, as other folks have done, I really want to recognize the leadership of both Speaker Kotek as well as all the parties at the table and really thank them. And this is a beginning. It's going to take a lot of work. And so I'm excited that Housing and Community Services has agreed to convene us going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a quick question. Frankly, I'm just very much in favor and a proponent of private and public partnership. I mean, we're all in this together, and we need to figure out ways to encourage that. You said something about other states have implemented similar bills, and I'd be interested in knowing how they've dealt with the risk management, if they've got some data or...
I have not actually, Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, I have not actually seen data on risk mitigation pools in other states. I can look for that, and I'll let you know if I find anything.
Thank you.
If you get it to Debbie and the
will.
Whole committee, we'll
get yes.
That would be great. Thank you. Committee, I wish we had, do you think you could wait? Janet, you're in Salem, aren't you?
I am,
sure.
Yes.
And it wasn't a question, it was
bring
a
her back. Okay, we can bring her back another time.
Great.
So I'm sorry, committee, because we do have another bill, and I want to make sure that we hear from people who come a long way. Janet, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
And we probably will have you back again. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2639. Thanks to all of you who've worked on this. We're certainly not finished. We're going to be working some more, so feel free to give us any printed information that you have, or either today or in the future, and be glad to take that into consideration. And if you'd leave quietly, that would be wonderful, because we're going to open up the first public hearing on House Bill 2417.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2417 has a revenue statement and a fiscal impact statement, a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It raises county clerk property filing and recording fees from $15 to $20 for purposes of assisting veterans, requires minimum 25% of monies deposited in emergency housing account to assist veterans at risk of becoming or currently experiencing homelessness, allocates 25% homeownership assistance account fund minimum to serve low-income veterans and families of veterans.
Representative Wissant, did you want to?
Yes, ma'am. I can just do it from here.
Sure, that's great. Perfect.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honorable colleagues, I'm proud to bring this bill. Actually, it's Representative Greg Matthews' bill, and he was nice enough to ask me and Representative Parrish to be co-chief sponsors on this bill. Colleagues, it is a tax increase. So we're asking for a fee increase here to help our veterans. We're adding $5 to the filing fee that we imposed in 2009, which I also voted for. But this is for a worthy cause. We'll remember George Washington's farewell address when he said our ability to maintain, defend our nation, maintain an army dependent upon how we served those who served our nation in uniform. Mm-hmm. And this is what this is all about. We need homes, we need shelters, as our military community from World War II and Vietnam ages. This is a very important bill, and I hope the bill started in Veterans Committee, passed out of Veterans Committee, and will go from here to Ways and Means. I ask your support of this bill, and I'll yield the rest to my friends from Central Oregon.
Thank you. And we have Ryan Fisher and Richard Bonebreak, and we also have a couple of people from 100 miles away. Chuck Hemingway, and Richard. Oh, I've already said Richard's name. Okay, come on up. Thank you for coming so far. We really appreciate it. And sorry you had to wait so long, and thank you for waiting.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm going to be very brief because I want you to hear from Chuck and from Richard and also Val Valfrey, who's traveled from Washington County to speak with you.
Okay.
I had some slides, but I'll save those for another time. I want to start by just letting you know something, which is that right now, veterans age 18 to 30 are twice as likely to be homeless as those who have not served our country, two times as likely. And this is because the stress and the trauma of active duty have lifelong impacts. It impacts the veterans, it impacts their families, and it impacts our communities. And when I talk about that, I say that because as people, when we don't know where we're going to sleep, when we don't know where our next food, our next meal is going to come from, we go into fight or flight mode. We're in survival mode. And we're not thinking about the future. We're not thinking about our potential. We're thinking about that moment and where we're going to sleep that night. And when we lose that, we lose our potential. We lose our communities are losing that potential. We're losing teachers. We're losing entrepreneurs. We're losing leadership. And that's why this is such an important issue. The good news is that we have some answers to this. We know that when we can make sure that a veteran has a safe place to live, that it can make a real difference. We know that we can connect them to services much more successfully when they have stable housing. And we have a bill that will help us to do that. And again, I want to make sure that these other folks have an opportunity to speak. I'm happy to get into more details about the bill. Maybe if you have questions, we have time, but I'd like to turn it over now to Chuck and to Richard.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Gumberg, and a special thank you to Representative Wisdom, my representative, and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Hemingway. I'm with Central Oregon Veterans Outreach. We're a nonprofit that serves all of Central Oregon, and we're based in Bend. Since 2005, we've provided assistance to veterans and their families that help them either from becoming homeless or get them rapidly rehoused. If they are homeless, then we get them stabilized and move them into permanent housing. Because of what we're seeing in Central Oregon regarding the serious housing issues that veterans in our area face, we think that HB 2417 is a very critical piece of legislation. It will complement a comprehensive program that we have had in place for several years now that we've developed and implemented, where we can take a homeless veteran from a tent into a permanent housing situation. Our program was created precisely because of the problems that we are currently seeing in Central Oregon and that HB 2417 will address. Under our housing program, I said we can take a veteran that's living in a tent or a car into permanent housing. We do that by first taking them into a transitional, an emergency transitional housing program that we call VETS, Veterans Emergency Transitional Services, under a partnership that we have with a local homeless shelter in our area called Bethlehem Inn. They can stay there up to 3 months while we explore other housing options. Then we can take them into another housing program that we have called Home of the Brave, which is a transitional housing program where they can stay up for up to 2 years, and we work with them in case management to identify those issues that caused them to become homeless in the first place and to work with them to overcome those. Then we can move them into another program that we have, which is permanent affordable housing at one facility we have in particular called Housing for Heroes. And we have 12 units there. We have 17 throughout Central Oregon, and we will soon have another six by May. And in this situation, they still receive case management services so that we're not throwing somebody into a housing situation and those issues that got them homeless in the first place are going to recur. What's wonderful about this is that we're currently working with our regional housing authority, with the City of Bend Affordable Housing Committee, and a couple of other nonprofits to move several of our veterans currently into home ownership. So that's the Holy Grail, to take someone from a tent into owning a home and then becoming a productive member of society. But the three accounts that HB 2417 will set up does precisely what needs to be done. We're living on a shoestring, and this will provide an assistance fund that will allow permanent. It will allow us to have people who can, if they're in danger of becoming homeless, can keep them housed. If they're homeless, can get them into housing. It will allow us to have a little bit of money that we can help to acquire other units to provide affordable housing, and then it's got the homeowner assistance fund that will allow these people to then get some money to help them buy a home of their own. It's wonderful. What we're seeing now is not just the Vietnam veterans and the Vietnam era veterans. We're seeing the global war on terrorism veterans post 9/11, And we're starting to see an increasing number. Year by year, they get more and more of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. We don't want the same thing to happen to the Vietnam-era veterans that happened there. We want to lay a foundation right now that we can address the issues that are going to come up for these young veterans who are just coming back and serve their country so valiantly. And HB 2417 will accomplish that. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Richard Bonebrick, and I'm disabled and a Vietnam veteran. I live in Bend, Oregon, at Housing for Heroes, which you just talked about. And instead of talking about the bill and all of that, I'm just going to talk to you about my experience. I was working, and then I became disabled, dependent on oxygen, and I could no longer work. I was on unemployment until that ran out, and I had my roommate passed away, and I was no longer able to afford where I was living. Well, in the meantime, I had gone to the hospital in Portland on the Disabled American Veterans Shuttle, and someone told me about Central Oregon Veterans Outreach. And I went there basically to help them, have them help me fill out some paperwork. And when I was talking to the person about the paperwork, I told him about my situation and the fact that I was just about to become homeless. And the person in the next cubicle came over and said, I think we can help you. And then he took me in to talk to Chuck. And the short end of that story is I was the first person to move into the Housing for Heroes complex. Now, when I moved in, there was only one building complete. There's three buildings. And the other two buildings were beyond condemnable. The ceilings were falling down. There was water damage on the walls. They had to take the units and strip them down completely to the studs and start over again. And now they're beautiful. They're just like they're brand new. So that's just an example of what they've done and what they can do. And I'm not a real good speaker. Oh, and also, I wanted to apologize for my phone earlier. I'm sorry about that. As a result of that, since I had all this time on my hands, I went and volunteered at COVO, and it really changed my life going down there and helping other people. And I work 2 days a week there, but I'm volunteering now for Bend Parks and Rec. I'm supervising a garden at the senior center, and I also work for the Central Oregon Council on Aging, where I work for one of their pizza lunches, and also I go into care facilities and I'm a notary. And so far, I've done 70 notaries, and I have not charged for one. I've been doing them free for veterans and free for people in care homes. And all of this is possible because they helped me out. And so now I want to help more people out. The other thing is all of my neighbors that are living there, now all three units are full. They're all veterans, and we're like a little community of our own. Everybody helps everybody else out. One of them, and most of them are going to school now. In fact, I go to OSU. It's not like regular school. I'm in the Master Gardeners program, but I'm enjoying the heck out of it. And some of them are going to school studying serious things. We've got everybody there from Afghanistan all the way back to Vietnam, where I came from. And one of the students, I'm helping him with math because I know how to do a little bit of math. When somebody needs a ride, the people that have cars give them a ride. I mean, it's everybody is working together to help everybody else out. And that's part of what this program does, and that's part of what they want to keep doing, and I want to keep being a part of it. And I want to thank you for listening to me, and thank you.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for your service in Vietnam. Thank you all. And Ryan, I know that you had a slide presentation. If you could just give that to Debbie, you can probably send it by email, which would just be fine.
Absolutely. And we have Val Valfrey here as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
Can I ask a question, Madam Chair? About how it operates? Well, thank you, first of all, for your
No, thank you.
Your service and your stories. It's very inspiring. Just operationally, the money is collected and goes into the county assessment and taxation fund, and then it gets divided into the general housing account, emergency housing account, and home ownership assistance account, and it designates a certain percentage of those to go to vets. Those programs are operated statewide, or does the county from the that's collected on a county basis stay on a county basis? Can you explain that to me, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. So the way that it works is, yes, the counties are the ones who are recording the documents, so they are the ones who make the collection. Then it is deposited into a state fund, and then the state allocates it back to communities. And for the homelessness dollars, that's allocated by formula to every county in the state. For the general housing account, those funds are allocated by a competitive funding process. So communities put together proposals, they send those in, and then those are funded through this competitive funding
that was process. The emergency housing account?
The first one is the emergency housing account.
Oh, that's the
one that is allocated exactly statewide. The second one is allocated by housing and community services through this competitive funding
process. That's the homeownership
process. That is the general housing account.
Okay.
And that is, so for instance, the place that they just described that has been rehabilitated, that would be the sort of thing that could be done with those dollars. And then the third piece is the home ownership. Currently, there is a network of regional housing centers which is utilizing the home ownership dollars, and so that is a vehicle that this could be money could get to veterans. Another potential is that it could be used at ODVA and paired with the Orvet loan as a down payment assistance to go with the Orvet home loan.
Mm-hmm. Just thank you very much, Val. I'm going to come up.
Madam Chair, as he's coming up, I want to let everyone know that Chuck Hemingway is, he keeps telling us he's going to retire, but he keeps doing all this good work. He was a vet, a judge advocate, and he's a real blessing to our community and to the vet community in Central Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks for the work you've done.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and honorable members of the committee. My name is Val Valfrey. I'm the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Washington County. I'm an appointed member of the Governor's State Housing Council, and more importantly, I'm a 25-year Air Force veteran and pilot with combat service in Vietnam. I thank you for hearing my testimony today regarding the critical need for veterans housing in Oregon. This testimony, however, is not about me. For I was fortunate to return back, after the war back to a home, a loving family, and a job. Rather, my testimony seeks to honor and to advocate for those like Richard and others who serve their country with valor and now in turn seek help from a grateful state and nation. Far too many veterans are homeless in America, estimated between 130,000 and 200,000 on any given night. More than three times as many veterans are struggling with rents that are their rent burden, they can't afford on their incomes, which puts them at increased risk for homelessness. What is even more staggering for me to comprehend is that one out of every three homeless persons who's sleeping on in a doorway or in an alley or in a cardboard box somewhere in the cities or in the rural areas at one time put on a uniform and serve this great country. I'm sure you would agree that this status quo is unacceptable. Oregon is the home of choice of many of our nation's veterans, over 330,000 both men and women, and nearly 250,000 with wartime experience. But along with that, and shamefully, over 1,500 veterans are homeless. This too is unacceptable, as we should never allow the words homeless and veteran to ever be used together. Nor should any veteran ever have to choose between living in the streets or being relegated to life's shadows, not if we are truly to honor their service to this great country. As a Housing Authority Executive Director, we have recently had as many as 6,000 families, both veterans and non-veterans, on our housing wait list. The veterans we see span a continuum of honorable service to Korea and Vietnam, all the way up to Afghanistan. They include single men and women, couples, and increasingly now, single women with children. These veterans are often distrustful of government and its promises and have little patience for bureaucratic barriers and excuses that sometimes lead to nowhere. So when these veterans do come in, come to our offices and make that effort to We must seriously commit to adding value to their efforts. I often remind my staff that they have one opportunity, and just one, to be patient and listen to what the veteran's trying to tell them. Just one opportunity to give factual and timely advice. Otherwise, the veteran's going to leave, and we would have done them a great disservice. We know that we know how to prevent and end homelessness for the veteran. We know how to build affordable housing to serve veterans, and we know how to help veterans access homeownership opportunities. With the additional resources that are being offered through this bill, this funding source, we should be able to significantly and positively impact veterans that are living in Oregon. In summary, I hope you will take away from our presentations that we need to restore honor and dignity to our veterans by providing housing, job training, and services. I thank you very much for your listening to my testimony and open to any questions.
And thank you so much for waiting for several hours.
Not at all, Chair.
For your testimony and for your service to the country. Any quick questions?
Representative Whitsitt. I just wondered if you know how much money you're expecting to take in, and secondly, is 100% of it going to Veterans Services?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, happy to answer that question. Thank you for it. So the estimations based on the current recordings are that within the first biennium, the 13-15 biennium, because of the way that the bill is timed, it would only collect for 3/4 of that time period. It would raise about $6 million, just under $6 million. In the following biennium, the projections are closer to $8 or $9 million. I think $8 million is the number that legislative revenue. And then to your question, it is all of the dollars that are raised by this bill will go to veterans. And you'll see the number 25 in there. That is because there's currently a $15 affordable housing fee. This would expand it by $5. So 25% of the total fee will be for veterans, but all of the $5 that we're talking about today would be for veterans.
Thank you.
Good question. Thank you. Thank you very much. Any closing comments, Representative Wisnett?
No, ma'am. Thank the committee. Hope we can work it soon and get it down to Ways and Means so they can approve it and start the process. Thank you very much,
great.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for being this with us today. With this, we'll close the public hearing on 2417. Thank you, committee, for staying. And Representative Wisnett, thank you for bringing this bill to us. Without paying attention. Representative Wisnett, I was giving you a thanks for bringing this bill to us. And also, pardon?
Oh,
Greg Matthews, too. The connection between human services and housing. This is a great thing that we deal with both of these here. So thank you. And with that, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.